Ferns have been around for millions of years and are among the oldest plants on Earth, as a matter of fact. And next up, we talk with fern expert Moby Weinstein. We'll talk about the history of these well-loved plants. We look at their basic botany and how to care for them. And it's great to have Moby with us. She's foreman of Gardeners for Outdoor, I should say foreman of Gardeners for Outdoor Gardeners at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. She's a lecturer, a plant judge, and an author of two books on ferns. I have in front of me her book titled The Complete Book of Ferns. And I have really enjoyed going through this book. It's fascinating. Moby Weinstein, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
So what is it about ferns that has drawn you to them?
Well, I didn't choose them per se at the very beginning. I just love all plants. And very early on in my career at the Botanical Garden in New York, I was assigned to take care of the ferns. So I said, well, if I'm going to take care of them, I need to know a little bit about them. And was very fortunate that we had scientists on our staff that were world authorities on ferns. We had meetings every month of the New York chapter of the American Fern Society. And so immediately I got engrossed in them and then, of course, fell in love with them even more.
Well, you know, we see ferns in every dinosaur movie.
Exactly.
Give us a little of the history of ferns. When do we think they first appeared on Earth?
Well, the first land plants really came on about 450 million years ago or so. You know, it's quite a long time ago. Well, first plants, let's say that, not land plants so much. And then the ferns were the first to become what we call vascular, making a specialized tissue that allowed them to kind of move out of the water and onto the land. And so they precede all of our seed-producing plants, because they came on the scene probably about 350 million years ago. And they were probably from the ancient ferns that don't make seed but make spore. There, we know from the fossil records that there are some plants we call seed ferns that were probably that transition, that we don't have any of those alive today, but probably were the transition to our modern-day seed plants. So they've been around for a really, really long time, colonizing great parts of the planet and giving us our coal deposits that we've been using and using and using from buried giant forests of the ancient ferns, the lycophytes, that were 100 or 150 feet tall and that got buried during, you know, continents colliding and all kinds of massive changes on our planet. And those deep buried reserves are what we use now as coal.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And, you know, they're unique, I think, in the plant world because, as you were talking about, they produce not by flowers or seeds but via spores.
Yes, so the first plants were the algae in the water. And then the what we call the mosses, which most people have heard of, and things like liverworts, which maybe people haven't heard of. These were just very low, flat, filmy plants that kind of hugged the water surface. They kind of moved out of water, but they had to be in contact with water all the time, basically. And it was really from them, they reproduced by spore. From then, we kind of got the ferns, who also reproduced by spore. But what they did, which was an enormous change, which hasn't really been changed since then, is they developed what we call a vascular system. It's like not the same, obviously, as what we have in humans or animals, a vein and artery system, a system that conducts water and nutrients and the sugars that it makes in photosynthesis through the plant body. So it's like our blood moving through our body. It's their stuff moving through their bodies to keep them alive. And that's what enabled them to get away from the water, to be able to put roots down into the soil and take water out, and to be able to get taller and bigger and stronger. And yeah. That system, that vascular system, is really important. And we don't have anything more advanced than that today. So they have one step in the, what we call the ancient world, their ancestral world, reproducing by spore. And they have the one foot in the modern world, the evolved world, with their vascular system. So they are unique in having that. It's a very distinct difference.
And they were used, they were used differently, or they've been used by humans over the years in different ways, I guess. How did humans use ferns in the past?
Well, they've always been used as ornaments. Many of them are just really attractive, and something in them calls to us, because it's very typical that when people see certain types of ferns, particularly things like the maidenhairs, people are drawn to them. People are drawn to plants. We know this, and research has proven this now. We are naturally drawn to nature and to plants, and our blood pressure goes down when we get into the forest mm-hmm. and things like this. So we know we respond to this. But ferns have, a lot of them with their textures and their forms, have just really drawn people to them. And in the mid-1800s, which is not so long ago, we had, well, in Europe, they had the Victorian fern craze. And what really led to that was the fact that Dr. Ward had invented the Wardian case. He was an amateur science person, and he was collecting ferns. And in Europe, with the burning of coal, there was so much pollution and the air was dry that he developed this little case, and he kept his plants alive in that. And so it's called the Wardian case after him. And that made a great change for people to be able to grow things they couldn't grow indoors. And it was a big craze. And they went all over England, particularly, unfortunately, collecting so much that they really overcollected and endangered many plants. It was such a craze. But we're able to keep them alive in their parlors, in their homes, and it was exciting to show people what they had. And the forms, you can also see how beautiful the forms of ferns are, because you see them in benches, you see them in signs, you see them in pictures. Every time you look at a catalog, even for furniture, you'll see a picture of a couch in a living room setting, and what's on the wall is a print of a fern leaf. So you see them everywhere, because they do have great forms, and they're attractive to us as plants are, but ferns seem to be a little more so. And so you see them everywhere. So people have been using them. We don't eat too much of them, but we do eat fiddleheads. And depending on where you are in the world, people eat different species. Probably you have it in Wisconsin as well, but certainly in the Northeast here, the one we usually eat are the fiddlehead ferns, the ostrich ferns, the fiddleheads of the ostrich fern, one of our natives. And so we eat those, but they're also eaten in other parts of the world. There is one, though, that has been eaten, and we do know that it probably is somewhat carcinogenic, and so we wouldn't recommend that one. That's bracken fern, which is really a joke in the fern world, that we say there's only one bracken plant in the world, and it's connected across the entire world. It is a massive plant that just spreads, and that's why we joke it spreads so much. We think it's just one continuous plant. So it's a great plant, but we think that we know that that one you probably shouldn't eat so much of.
Penny in Winona, Minnesota has a comment or a question. Let's go there. Penny,
sure.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. I probably missed it when I was talking to the person who answered, but I had the ferns at my house in New Jersey. So hello, Doctor, from my native New Yorker. And I just have a question, because the ones that you can eat, are they the ostrich ferns that you can eat the little
fiddleheads
and the mistress? Yes, the fiddleheads. Thank you. It was blanking.
Yes.
I got those growing in my garden in New Jersey, and they became very invasive. I loved them, but they really went crazy. Now, I was interested in putting them by where I had some evergreens on the border of my property here in Minnesota. And is that, do you know if that's something that I should have a problem with being, like, invasive to Minnesota? They do have room where I want to put them to kind of go free.
Right. So we wouldn't technically call it invasive because it would be native for you. And just so you know, if a plant is very aggressive, but it's native, then it's naturally evolved in that habitat, and we don't call it invasive. But yes, as you have learned from experience, it does spread. And in areas where you want that great covering, that's fantastic. If you have a very limited space, you will kind of always be pulling it out. I have grown it in containers in spaces where I didn't want it to colonize. So it would probably act much the same for you as it did in New Jersey. And so that's really for you to choose. But if you pull it up every year, like if every year you do a little, you would maintain it. If you let it get out of control, that's when it's going to start taking hold, and that will be a bigger job for you to dig out.
Yeah,
I hope that helps.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Penny, thanks a lot for calling. Our guest, Moby Weinstein, her book is The Complete Book of Ferns. That's one of her books, anyway. It's a dandy book on ferns, and it's fun talking with her about them. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here visiting with Moby Weinstein, foreman of gardeners for outdoor gardens at the New York Botanical Garden. And her book is that I've had a chance to look at and really love. It's called titled The Complete Book of Ferns. You know, when I think about ferns, sort of like a Boston fern comes to mind. The lace of the leaves, and really quite beautiful. But ferns, I mean, you look at a tongue fern, for example. Now, that doesn't look like a fern.
Exactly. It's something that people do. When I ask people what makes a plant a fern, of course, most people don't know, but they think, oh, it has very lacy, delicate leaves.
Yeah.
And many of them do, but many of them do not. And you would look at that plant and not guess at all that it's a fern, unless you started to know something about, oh, they make spores, and you happen to look and you might recognize that it's making spores on the back of the leaf. But they are so really diverse. There's about 12,000 species, really worldwide, except for Antarctica, where apparently in the fossil record it shows they were there at one point, but not now. And so some are very large, very coarse, and some are very fine. And there's shades of light green to dark green and even bluish or, you know, like a grayish color. And then you have the painted fern, which is a very common one for outdoors, which has silver and often red in it. So they're really quite diverse, and people don't always recognize one if it's not a more common one that they've seen.
Yeah. And, you know, you take one like the ribbon fern, for example, where you've got sort of a green edge along the outside of the leaf and then a sort of a very, very light green center to it.
Yes. Yes.
It's beautiful.
And white and silver. Yeah. And their forms, between their forms and their colors and even their textures, they can be a very thick, leathery texture, which often tells you they might do better without some humidity, because the ones that are very thin and delicate usually need more humidity. But they do give great, you know, not only their form, but their texture and their colors. And if you can mix, and there's plenty for indoors that, if you're an indoor grower, those, or if you're in a tropical climate, you can do them outdoors. But you guys are not tropical, as we are not in New York.
That's for sure. Oh, boy. Well, you know, you think about ferns in humid settings.
Right.
Do we need to create that indoors?
Well, here we go again. This is where most of our homes do not have good humidity. And so, number one, it's better for us if the humidity is higher, especially in wintertime. It's better for our health as well as the plants. But if you can't humidify, there are some ferns that are really well adapted. And the one you named, the ribbon fern, is one of the terrace ferns. Those are generally pretty good for growing indoors. They don't need a lot of attention. And some of the bird's nest ferns, and one of the, we don't necessarily call it the Boston fern, but it's a very close relative. We call it the sword fern. And it basically looks the same, but it's a different species. And that is really tough for indoors. So I have an apartment in New York City, and I live with the same problems that a lot of indoor people have, high heat and dry air. And so these are ones that they do not get babied. They survive. They're good growers. The maidenhairs are the opposite. They tend to have very delicate leaves, and if they don't have enough humidity, they will just fry on you. And a point to make about humidity that I find a lot of people maybe don't understand, or just out of desperation might try. Watering the soil doesn't make up for humidity in the air. So if your air is so dry, you can't keep watering the plant to make up for it. You wind up just rotting it. So grouping your plants together helps. Of course, having a humidifier will help greatly. And also, if you're trying to increase the humidity, put them on little trays or saucers, where you have water in the tray so it can evaporate and cool and humidify the air. Just make sure the base of the pot or container is not sitting in the water. Usually you put pebbles or marbles or something like that to keep it above the water so it doesn't keep the soil wet, but it keeps the air more humid. You'd be amazed how quickly that evaporates. You could be filling it every day, and that's how you realize, wow, the air is really dry.
Bev in Rhinelander has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bev.
Hi. I'm wondering if you are familiar with the black rabbit's foot fern.
Uh-huh.
I have one. It's beautiful, easy to take care of, but it has a very unusual, I guess it's a root. It gets all fuzzy and grows all over the place underneath, around the pot.
Right. So that's not actually the root. Everyone thinks it is because it's not typical for us to see that. It's actually the stem that you see. And the stem is covered in those are Dahlias. And that group is kind of known for having these long creeping rhizomes, we call them. It's a modified stem. And they're covered with hairs, which is why often they look like a rabbit's foot, and some have a whiter scales and hairs. They're really more scales, and some have more brown, and some have almost more black, and they can be slender or very thick. It all depends on the species. But they normally don't grow in the soil. They like to grow on rocks or on other trees or plants, and then they have just small root systems that kind of cling onto those things. but it makes them very attractive for us. If you're ever repotting it and they're growing outside, that means they're happy. Don't take them and stick them into the soil, because that will rot them, because they're used to being out in the air. And luckily, they are pretty tolerant of drier conditions, so they make a good houseplant for us. But they also have a very handsome leaf. But their little creeping stems like that are very curious, and it people are like, this is fun. What's this? And then they you can pet them. You don't have a cat or a dog to pet.
Oh, Bev, thanks a lot for calling. By the way, Mary emailed back to the ostrich ferns for a minute. She says, yes, ostrich ferns take over in central Wisconsin, just like in New York. She says she's speaking from experience.
Yes, and I know that feeling.
Oh, man. You know, probably the most, perhaps the strangest fern that I noted in your book was the squirrel's foot fern, which I would never guess was a fern.
It
does look almost like a squirrel's tail to me, but tell us about the squirrel's foot fern.
Yeah, that's also one of the Dahlias, right? So that picture in the book that you can see, other people probably can't, is exactly what Bev, I think I got her name right, was just asking about, her Dahlia, her rabbit's foot. So they're called rabbit's foot, squirrel's foot, it depends on it. But it's really the stem, and they're just covered with these scales. And that helps to protect them a little, because they are sitting out there exposed. But what they'll do if you grow them in a basket, if it's a plastic basket, they don't really adhere to it. But if it's clay and it's porous, they'll often kind of stick to it a little, and especially if it's a moss basket, then they will definitely grow around the outside, and you will see all of that kind of fuzzy stem around the bottom and then the green leaves on top. But it's not something you want to camouflage. It's actually something you want to see. It's part of the interesting part of the plant.
Oh, definitely, definitely is. So what are the varieties you most recommend for growing inside?
For inside, I would recommend the bird's nest fern, particularly the Japanese one, which is botanically Asplenium antiquum. I find that to be, and not just myself, but if you read about it, probably other people will say as well, that one of the species is probably the easiest indoors, and it's a little smaller, although keeping it in small pots will prevent it from getting 2 feet long each leaf. I have them, as I said, in small pots in my apartment, and they're not bigger than, 12 inches across the entire plant. That's because it's in a small pot. If I keep potting it up and potting up, I could get it to be 2 to 4 feet across, but that would be too big for me. But in our greenhouses, at the Botanical Garden, we do have them that large, but they stay a little smaller, but they just tolerate indoors beautifully. And there are some very cool varieties of it. They tend to, what we say, fork at the tips, so they get crested and their tips get all funny looking and people love them, or the edges get ruffled. So there are also some nice varieties of those. The brake ferns or the terrace ferns are also give us some good coloring, as you were mentioning, and are easy. The Dahlias, the squirrel's foot, rabbit's foot, hare's foot, those are great. The Japanese holly fern is a good indoor fern as well. Might be hardy for some people depending on where they live, but not for your climate and our climate. Those are some of my favorites of them. And also the sword fern that I mentioned, the Nephrolepis cordifolia, is a wonderful one for indoors.
That's a really cool plant. I like those leaves.
Yeah.
Well, your book here, we're running out of time, but I did want to mention the back part of your book where you have talking about terrariums and creating them and pressed fern art. are just absolutely fabulous. And
thank you.
And the artwork is great, and I love the cover, the complete book of ferns. And Moby, it's been a pleasure. Would you come back and be with us again? Love to have you back.
I would love to. Absolutely. Anytime.
Moby Weinstein.
It's nice to speak to other people.
And we'll have more people for you to talk with next time around. Moby Weinstein.
Great.
She is the
thank
foreman
so
of,
much.
Yes, thank you for being with us. She's the foreman of gardeners for outdoor gardens at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. And her book is one of the two books, but the book I have in front of me is The Complete Book of Ferns. Fantastic book. Well, we have a fantastic group of people to work on this program. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud. We've got technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins with me today. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. Thank you so much for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.